Game on, weeknights from 6
on 2FM.
Thanks to Bette Gisova for taking us through the afternoon here on 2FM. It's Tuesday, the 24th of September, and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show with Dermot O'Brien at 7 o'clock, Keith Tracy and Fergal Brennan will delve into all the latest in the world of football.
They most certainly will. In Formula 1, we will talk to Declan Quigley even after Lando Norris won the Singapore Grand Prix, but there's been much more happening off the track there as well. And last night, myself and Marie got nowhere near Colin Walsh and Thomas Carty's fights last weekend, so Kevin Byrne will join us on the line, and if we can manage to stick to script, we might even look at tomorrow's Kerry Nashton in the stall.
If you want to have your say, you can text us on 51552, WhatsApp us on 1-087-187-9200, and we're on X at Game On 2FM.
Game On 2FM.
If you tuned in yesterday, you'll know that we have a giveaway all week, an EA Sports FC 25 giveaway. And if you're a football fan or love gaming, we've got a great prize for you this week. EA Sports FC 25 is launching this Friday, and we're teaming up with EA Sports to give away a copy of the game every single day this week.
FC 25 is the highly anticipated follow-up to last year's hit, and this year they're bringing even more excitement with the return of the 10 SSE Airtricity Men's Premier Division teams.
So to celebrate the launch of EA Sports FC 25 this Friday, we're giving away a copy of the game every day, plus on Friday's show we'll throw in an Ireland jersey with the final prize as well. To be in with the chance to win today, all you have to do is answer the following question. Which team won the men's SSE Airtricity League in 2023? Was it Bray Wanderers or Shamrock Rovers?
Text your answer, name and email address to 51552 right now, and we'll announce the winner before the end of the show. As always, RTE competition terms and conditions apply. See 2fm.ie for all the details.
Now, and we will announce, as Ruby says yesterday, if we remember, we will announce it at the end of the show. So I'll go into plan. We will do that. We did that yesterday. 1 out of 1. We're on a roll now, so we're going to keep that going.
That's pressure now, Marie.
Keith Tracy is with us in studio, with me in studio, fresh from watching Shamrock Rovers and Bowes last night. I guess in a way it was uneventful, but yet really, really important, because now Shamrock Rovers could potentially win the league.
Yeah, look, mathematically they're right in the mix, our Shamrock Rovers, but Shelbourne do still have that game in hand. I didn't think it was the best quality game last night. I thought both teams got into decent positions but didn't really make the most of it. There was a couple of occasions where Bowes nicked the ball in decent positions, but Grant in particular didn't get his head up once when Tierney was bursting through. And the first minute of the game, maybe the second minute of the game, Darragh Bourne should really score. He's got he's about 3 yards out and he manages to hit the post. So yeah, I thought there was a lot of really good aspects in it. It was a typical Dublin derby. There was tackles flying in. The Bowes press was really, really clever. They were happy to go and let the three Rover centre-halves, Grace, Lopez and Cleary, stay on the ball. And as soon as they came into midfield, they just closed the door and start pressing from there. So really competitive game. But when you look at who Rovers can bring off the bench and Bourke coming off as well and Farrugia coming on the pitch, it's just, you're thinking, you know, Bowes have done so well, kept them really quiet for so long, and then they're bringing on, you know, international class players. And the goal from Graham Bourke towards the end of the game, he was threatening once or twice. He had a lovely free kick that Cherasca managed to save in the Bowes goal, and the goal he scores, it was a lovely goal. It comes out to the edge of the 18 yard box and he could have easily trashed at it, and you know, it could have been wild, but it was a really cultured finish, passed it into the back of the net. Cherasca couldn't get near it. And look, I think Alan Reynolds, I listened to his interview after the game, he feels there's a free kick in the build up. He thinks Farrugia fouls Paddy Kirk in the corner, and I did highlight it in the commentary. I did feel there was a little bit of pressure there, but the referee played on, and again, take nothing away from the finish.
And he went to them after as well, to the linesman and to the referee, and they said nope.
I'm really not surprised. You know, we had Michelle O'Neill in on Saturday Sport on Saturday, and the first thing I said to her was, when referees explain themselves, you can deal with it. Mm-hmm. But when they just tell you to go away and that's just deal with it, it really does grind on people. So the best referees will always take a second to explain their decision to me, and you know, it's that's the way it should be.
That's the second time I've heard you quoting Michelle O'Neill. You're obviously very impressed with her, or learned a lot from her almost as well. Because the other thing you said was that you really like it when they're consistent. So it's like you're happy for them to enforce the rules as long as they do it the whole way through.
Yeah, well, yeah, then as a player, you know where you stand. If they book you in the fourth minute for kicking the ball away and they don't book you in the 80th minute for kicking the ball away, that's when you're thinking, OK, well, why are you changing the rules? It has to be the same level of lenience throughout the 90 minutes. And as long as they're consistent, I don't think it can really... But the one reason I keep talking about Michelle O'Neill is she's probably the only referee I've sat down with and had a bit of a chat with. All other referees just wave their hands and tell me to go away. So she's the only referee I've had a chat with.
Well, I think it's the opportunity that they have missed in football with VAR. If referees just explained their decisions, it would do away with a lot of contention. But Rovers had all the possession, all the shots, and completed most of their passes. But what about Bowes? Does this loss, they've got Dundalk Friday night, away to Dundalk. Well, there's a good gap between Dundalk and Bowes, but is it putting Bowes under pressure losing last night?
Yeah, Bowes are definitely under pressure, Ruby. I do think they'll be fine. I think Dundalk and Drogheda are in perilous positions, but mathematically Drogheda are still capable of catching Bowes. They managed to beat Bowes on Friday night, which was a big one. But the one thing from a Bowes point of view, looking at them last night, they don't have an out-and-out centre-forward. It was Grant sometimes was up front, sometimes it was McDonald, sometimes even Tierney and Rooney were being the lone striker up there, and there were so many straight balls going up front that they just weren't competing up there. And again, they got into decent positions where you're expecting them to go and click, or that killer pass, just some composure. And it was just lacking, and largely it was lacking in both teams, to be honest. But Shamrock Rovers managed to just come up with that minute. But yeah, Ruby, I think Bowes will be looking over their shoulders, but I expect them to be fine. And not because Bowes are so good and they're going to win a couple of games. I just don't see Drogheda winning enough games or getting enough points on the board to overtake Bowes.
We have a real title race now, though, don't we? And you see Shamrock Rovers coming into really good form. They have those couple of European games thrown into the run-in as well, so they're going to be stretched on all fronts. But you did mention they've got a super bench and so many players to pull on when they need them. But what situation is Damien Duff in now? He must be under savage pressure.
Yeah, you can feel it. You can feel it building up. And I think it just needs somebody to crack a joke. You can feel the tension all around the room. And look, Damien Duff's been in it at the top of the Premier League with Chelsea. He's felt, you know, big, big pressure. And the one thing he's been consistent in saying is, you know, there's pressure at the top of the league and there's pressure at the bottom. The pressure at the bottom is 10 times worse. So if you're a Shelbourne player and you're in this title race, just try and put yourself into Dundalk's shoes or Drogheda's shoes. That's real, real pressure. That's putting dinner on the table pressure. So if you're a Shelbourne fan, Shelbourne player, get behind your team. Give them one little last push. And look, they still have a game in hand. If they can manage to win the game in hand, it's back up to 7 points difference from Shamrock Rovers. I know Derry are the closest, but for all Shelbourne are top of the league, Derry are second, Rovers are third. Nobody's really mentioning Derry to win the league. Yeah. It's like everybody said, they're not consistent enough, which is crazy because they're right in the mixer. But whoever does win the league will be renowned as crawling towards the line because nobody's really took the mantle up and, you know, run with it.
Shells have a difficult run in, but a lot of their games are at home, and that has to be a huge advantage.
It is, yeah, but the people keep saying to me the way Shelbourne are playing, they're not free-flowing, they're not scoring goals. If they can win every game 1-0, I don't think any Shelbourne fan would care. I don't think Damien Duff would care. The big one for me, Shamrock Rovers have 4 home games, including last night. They did really well, got the win last night. They've Pats on Friday at home as well, which is another huge game. St. Pats are probably the most informed team in the league right now, so that's going to be a tough game. Then they have Applewell in the European competition. 3 days later, they've got Shells as well at home. So it's a big couple of weeks for Shamrock Rovers, and they need to come out the right side of that. Then it would be all taking shape. But everybody has 6 games to play. Shamrock Rovers have 12 games to play. I know I'm sitting here highlighting their bench, but it's in a long, hard, tough season to throw them games on the end of it. It's going to be a big, big ass. And if Shamrock Rovers do go on to win the league, and given what they've already done in Europe, it'll be an unbelievable season.
Before Shells face Shamrock Rovers on the 6th of October, will they have to have beaten Sligo Rovers and St. Pat's?
Yeah, I think they do. I think they need for themselves just to get that little bit of confidence back in the dressing room. You can see that it's starting to drain. They've got a big, big game on Friday against Sligo. So the one thing with Sligo as well, Ruby, is I was doing the game a couple of weeks ago when I said that Sligo were the most informed team in the league, and Drogheda went and beat them 7-0. So you just really don't know what this league is going to throw up.
You said that before the game.
I said that live in the game, that I think Sligo were the most informed team, and they went and got battered 7-0 by Drogheda. So look, it's
they had
a
the telly on the dressing room, did they?
It's the most topsy-turvy league in the world, but it's very, very entertaining. And trying to call the next result is, I think anybody's getting Inverness is as good as anybody, but Shelbourne, for me, they need to go and beat Sligo on Friday just to get that little bit of confidence back into the group.
Well, as a spectator, it's great, because that's what you want. You want to have a few teams up there battling, and there's going to be so many more twists and turns over the next few weeks as well. It's great. We're going to turn our attention to football across the water now. Fergal Brennan joins us on the line. I'm actually going to start with you, Keith, because you're an Arsenal fan, as we know. You like to keep it quiet, but I think it's more that you never like to get your hopes up about anything. What was your take on the City performance?
The City performance, I thought they were okay. Second half, I thought Arsenal were absolutely brilliant. And I know people would be rolling their eyes saying it was boring, it was defensive. But when you talk about all the top teams in the Premier League, i.e. Manchester City, Chelsea, Spurs, Liverpool, whoever else you want to throw into that mixer, it's all about attacking football. Very rarely do you mention their defence, and with Arsenal you can mention their defence. And I loved it. I was sitting watching the game, and Trossard gets sent off just before half time, which is a sending off. He deserved the really, really silly thing he did. But I go back to Doku kicking the ball away earlier on in the half, and the referee points and goes, oh well, it's only there, it's not the yardage of where the ball travels, it's delaying the restart. And Doku delayed the restart. When Manchester City scored their goal at the end, Haaland picks up the ball and bounces it off Gabriel's head. You know, that can't happen. I know it wouldn't have hurt, I know it wasn't a big deal, but there'll be kids watching this and thinking, okay, maybe I'll pick the ball up and bounce it off somebody's head. There was a lot of weird, and to be fair, Michael Oliver's probably the best referee in England, so it just got away from at times. But look, when half time came and I heard all the pundits on Sky Sports saying Arsenal can't defend for 45 minutes, Manchester City are too good, I hate when people can see that. Sometimes you have to go and make the other team prove that you are that good. So when Arsenal went to six at the back and three in front, I thought, lovely. But imagine being in that Arsenal dressing room and Mikel Arteta saying, we're not playing with a striker. You know you're going to suffer for the whole of the second half. And the fact that the Arsenal players were prepared to suffer and gave everything for the jersey, it just made me think, yeah, this is exactly what I want from my club. This is what I want to get behind. And, you know, I wouldn't be one for giving it all that, but I felt really proud of Arsenal, because they could have easily went and lost that game with the attacking talent that Manchester City had. So, not the prettiest thing on the eye, but a really well-earned, grind-out a point at Manchester. I liked it.
I asked Paul and Stephen last night, because to me it struck me when City did score, the deflation in the Arsenal players. Would you have any worry about that?
No, I don't think so, Ruby. I don't think it'll linger into, you know, the next game and the next game. I think the lads just gave absolutely everything, and, you know, they didn't have an awful lot of possession. They were pinned back into their 18-yard box. It was running out 10 yards, running back 10 yards, running out, running in. And you could see Manchester City were just monopolising the ball. Any time Arsenal chipped the ball forward, it was basically just wave after wave of attack. And you could see, the one thing I like, again, you say there was one or two players on the hands and knees, you know, heartbroken. Declan Rice picked up the ball, and you could see him telling them to get up, this game's not over, keep going. And I like that, because you need leaders like that in the dressing room. And I'm sure Mikel Arteta, although he put his hand around Trossard when he came off, I'm sure there was a couple of lads with a few choice words for him at half time, because stupidity in the end has cost Arsenal. It's really, really silly. I can sit here and give out about the refereeing decisions, but Trossard does kick the ball away and he does deserve a second yellow card. So stupidity has cost Arsenal in the end, but still very, very proud of them.
Fergal Brennan is with us as well. Fergal, things move on so quickly, and it moved on fairly rapidly to Rodri and his injury, and we're not sure how serious it is, but we know it's going to be serious. No time frame yet, but how much is the Rodri absence going to hurt Man City this season?
Massively. Everybody points to the fact that Manchester City have got this incredible squad, and obviously the financial reserves that they have, and the ability to go out and effectively buy who they want, depending on Guardiola's whim. But Rodri, he's the best in the world in his position, and the type of position that he plays in, and the way that he plays is central to literally, and in terms of the way that he goes about things, to Manchester City. Erling Haaland gets the headlines because of the goals that he scores, and Kevin De Bruyne. Rodri's the heartbeat of that team. He's the organiser. He's the driving force through the middle of the pitch. He offers the control to allow five or six players in front of him to go and win the match for City. And there are options to obviously step in. I think Mateo Kovacic, at the start of the season, when Rodri was missing after injuring himself against England in the Euro 2024 final, he did a really good job, but he's not Rodri. For me, Rodri's the closest to Busquets from Barcelona in terms of the way that he plays and the way that he just controls and manages a game. Is huge for City, because he's irreplaceable in world football. I as we sit here now, I don't think they'll go out in January and buy somebody, because he is crucial to them and will come back into the team when he recovers from the injury. It's just a case of, will he be seen before the end of the season? There's obviously a lot of kind of nerves around making a prediction how long he'll be out for. If it is a cruciate, it probably will be the full season, or certainly until late March, April time. If City are in a position to bring him back in, that he can play some football before the campaign is finished, that would obviously be a big positive. But the bulk of his campaign is over. And this is a real challenge for Guardiola to figure out either an individual or a system that covers for him not playing, because it's massive, massive, massive for them.
Well, time does move on and they will have to put out 11 players at some point next week. So what does Pep Guardiola do?
I think it'll be Kovacic, certainly in the short to medium term. They'll also look to manage his game time because they've got Carabao Cup tonight against Watford, FA Cup after Christmas, Champions League with the extra couple of games that are involved in there. I think he will play a couple of different individuals. Rico Lewis can play in there with Kyle Walker now back fit at right back. But I think primarily it'll be Kovacic, and there'll be a huge amount of focus on him. He is very experienced. He's won major trophies. He's somebody that is depended on by Pep Guardiola, but it just what Rodri offers that is the big miss for City and for Pep Guardiola, because he's just so important to everything that they do. They do have players that can come in and play and ensure that there's not a gaping hole in the middle of the midfield, but I just think in them huge games between now and the end of the season, when they play Arsenal again, Liverpool home and away, the Manchester Derby with United, the big Champions League games, when the knockout stages roll round in February, March time, that's when we'll start to see just how competitive and up to it someone like Kovacic or Lewis or possibly even John Stones could get thrown in there. Calvin Phillips' name has been mentioned. I think we'll see a bit of him. I think there's a decent chance he might play tonight. But he's clearly not someone that is trusted by Guardiola for a Premier League campaign. So I think Kovacic, Lewis, Stones, Phillips will all be used in that position. But it's just a big blow for Guardiola.
Fergal, how long do you think it's going to take Arteta to get over the Man City game? He was still so spiky in his press conference ahead of that Bolton game.
Quite a while. He was seething this morning and kind of batted away a lot of questions and effectively refused to answer anything surrounding Sunday. And he was a bit snarky when he was asked about the dark arts and is he giving his players any instructions about quickly taking free kicks and that kind of thing. He's clearly annoyed by what happened. I'd agree with Keith in terms of the Gossard red card. It's not a horrible tackle or something like that, but it's a stupid decision made in a massively pressurised game, and he deserved the second booking and he deserved to go. But as for Arteta, I think this is now what he's creating at Arsenal, this idea of decisions are going to go against us. That's part of the situation when you're a team challenging for major trophies. You're going to have to get through these battles with your rivals. And that's kind of how he wants it, I think. I think he enjoys that element of the game. I think there's definitely players in that Arsenal team, Gabriel, Saliba, David Raya in goal, that enjoy that element of things as well. So I don't think he will get over it in terms of just shaking it off. I think he'll use it as a bit of petrol for his team moving forward. They also have got Carabao Cup this week. They play Bolton tomorrow. There'll be a huge amount of changes again. But he'll use that result and he'll use the motivation from it. And Keith mentioned there about the Declan Rice stance after the equaliser from City. I think a big part of that was also based on not wanting the defining image at the end of the game being Arsenal players on their knees, flat out and deflated, because that's what would be in the papers, that's what would be on social media. He and some of the other players knew you have to get up, you have to stand up, you walk off this pitch, because that's what title rivals do. Don't give any edge to Manchester City in that type of situation.
Fergal, moving north, I suppose. Good news for Everton. Fried King Group, who also own Roma, look like they're about to purchase Everton.
Finally, this looks like it's done. This was a situation that was floated back in June, and they had a deal in place that eventually then just didn't come to fruition. And then 777 stepped in, and that was a disaster. And I think that was the right decision, because there was never a huge amount of convincing proposals put forward by them. The hope now is that this can be sped through. It still needs ratification from the Premier League, but they're willing to buy out Farhad Moshiri's full controlling stake, which I think is about 94-95%. They've already released statements to the effect of that it's done. They just need the final little I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed to get it through. And Everton fans will be pleased, because whilst Moshiri has remained in place, because he has his financial limitations, they've not been able to bolster the squad in the way that they want and move forward as a Premier League team. How much it'll help them on the pitch, that they're still yet to win a game this season. But curiously, there's six Premier League teams that haven't won a game yet. So I don't think it's time to be hitting the panic button just yet for Sean Dyche and for the Everton fans. I get that they're frustrated. This is a big step forward. They've needed this sorting. Obviously, moving forward to next season with the new stadium. And it'll be a boost, because a Premier League football club needs a strong financial position.
Keith, you know Sean Dyche so well. That's a pretty grim stat, isn't it, that they haven't won a game yet?
Yeah, but I know exactly what will be getting said in the dressing room and within the training ground. They obviously lost to Bournemouth, but they went ahead against Aston Villa, done really well, and got pinned back in the last couple of minutes of that game. So they have been scoring goals. The one thing for me, the one question mark you have over the Sean Dyche team is, can they score some goals? The early signs are they can score goals. Unlike a Sean Dyche team, they've been conceding goals. So I'm sure he'll be walking and walking on the training ground, trying to shore up the defence. And look, they've lost some good players as well. Onana coming out of the middle of that midfield, I think, is a big one for them. They don't have the running power that they're used to. They've lost Iwobi as well over the last couple of seasons. So look, Everton, as grim as it sounds, I think the remit is to just stay in the league this season. And I know people will be saying, well, that's not great, they should be doing more. But with everything that's happening on the pitch, off the pitch, the takeover, the ill feeling at the club, it feels like it's on a knife edge. They only need to lose a couple of games and it feels like the fans are bang unhappy, and people are talking about, is Sean Dyche under pressure? Sean Dyche comes away from that club, he's the glue that's holding it all together. The pressure that's coming on and off the pitch, he's the only one that's, you know, it's not like Everton are getting rolled over. They've been unlucky in a couple of games. So look, they've drew with Leicester, they got beat by Southampton in the cup on penalties. They done really well against Aston Villa and got beat by Bournemouth. So they've been competitive in the games. They've just come out the wrong side of them. So I'm sure Sean Dyche will be very hopeful that they can come out the right side of the next couple.
You mentioned the importance of shoring up the defence there. I really thought that Jake O'Brien, maybe we overvalue someone because they're from your own country, but I thought he'd be the type of player that Sean Dyche would be putting right in there.
Yeah, well, look, again, I think Sean Dyche looks at the bigger picture. I don't think he's thinking, look, we'll just throw Jake in because we bought him. I think he's looking to think, this is an Everton team that's struggling at the minute. Do we really want to throw Jake O'Brien in there? And if he goes and makes a mistake, he could be scarred. So I do think Jake will come into the team at some point. But Sean Dyche is a very, very loyal manager. I know that because of my time there. So he will stick with Kane, Tarkowski, Braithwaite when he comes back. But what Jake has to do is train really well. One thing I know under Sean Dyche is training counts for an absolute lot. You can get yourself in the team between Monday and Friday, but you can also get yourself out of the team between Monday to Friday. So if Jake trains well, does well in the couple of cup games he's getting, and sometimes you just need a bit of luck, you know, somebody to get injured or something to get your place in there. So I wouldn't be pressing the panic button for Jake from any point of view. I do think he'll be in there, but you just have to bide your time from, you know, every now and then.
Fergal, while we're on the topic of Merseyside and Cork and players getting their opportunity, with Alisson out, it looks like Caoimhín Kelleher is going to get a few more games than we had expected him to.
Yeah, I think that the Carabao Cup game with West Ham, he would have been expected to come in, but a good performance the weekend against Bournemouth. And he will play until Alisson is back fit, but unfortunately that will just be a kind of temporary stopgap for him. I just think we go back to the same situation with him, and obviously during the last international break he was very straightforward about his situation and the frustration that he's got, and I think he knows, and he has effectively accepted the situation with Arne Slot, which is a practicality of Arne Slot is able to look at Kelleher and go, when I need you, you can come in and you will perform. The level won't drop significantly from Alisson, who's one of the best goalkeepers in the world. And that is a compliment, as much as it doesn't really change the situation that he's determined to be a number one for Liverpool or for elsewhere. That is the case. And we've seen that over the last few years, that every single time he comes in, he performs and he does exactly what is expected, and probably a little bit more than that. That run of Premier League games that he had last season, for me, demonstrated that, yes, if another Premier League team or aside from a top league across Europe comes in for him next summer, then he should go and he'll be perfectly able to cut it. Just for the moment, it's a situation whereby he needs to keep going as he is. because he is a very, very good goalkeeper, and everybody can see exactly the level that he's at. Unfortunately, it just is the way it goes with goalkeepers. And when you've got someone like Alisson in front of you, you need to either wait for an injury, which obviously nobody ever wants, or a situation where they move on, and that just does not look to be the situation.
No, it doesn't look to be the situation. Looking at tonight, the EFL Cup, Walsall, Leicester, Chelsea, Barrow City, Watford, Wickham, Aston Villa. Loads of second teams out from the Premier League sides trying to get themselves into the next round, I suppose.
Yeah, and you're kind of looking at it and saying, obviously, with that situation with teams who haven't won games so far this season, and Leicester might be the one that I'd kind of look at, because they, in terms of maybe a shock, they'll make plenty of changes, as will most of the other teams that are playing this week that are Premier League sides. I think they're in a position of going, we need that Premier League win at all costs. If that means that we put out a team and get knocked out of the Carabao Cup in midweek, then so be it. That'll be the trade-off. Where if you're a team that's had a couple of victories already this season and you're thinking, you know, we're safe, we've got a good solid basis to build on, why not go a little bit stronger in the cup? So I think, I don't know, if I was looking for maybe a shock, I'd maybe go for Leicester getting knocked out, just because they cannot afford to keep going along and not winning Premier League games if they don't want to find themselves in a situation going into Christmas where their fate is possibly already sealed.
That wouldn't be great. What about tomorrow night in the Europa League? Plenty of, well, not plenty, but a couple of English teams in action. Manchester United are away to 20? Twent?
FC 20, yeah. I imagine they'll get off to a fairly strong start. I think, again, we go back to the same thing with United, that you don't really know what you're going to get at the weekend. First half, excellent against Crystal Palace, but couldn't score. Half-time rolls around, they come back out after the break, the level dipped a little bit, they let Palace get back into the game more, and then there's obviously the situation with Eric Ten Hag answering questions about Marcus Rashford. So it'd be interesting to see if Rashford comes back into the team after being dropped to the bench at Selhurst Park. I think he will, and hopefully he might have a bit of a point to prove. I think United should be okay to get themselves off to a win, but I still think that there's more questions than answers when it comes to Ten Hag and United this season.
Keith, there'll be lots of people tuning in to see AZ Alkmaar, well, Troy Parrott playing for them more than them. They're playing Augsburg, and just it feels like a really good opportunity to see him on the European stage.
Yeah, why not? I've been impressed with him the couple of minutes he's got for Ireland here and there, and I'm just delighted that he's decided to go back to Alkmaar. He scored a lot of goals there last season. I'm sure he would have had a couple of suitors would have wanted to take him on loan, but he's gone back to a place where he feels comfortable. The league has only just started. They've 4 wins and 1 draw in their first 5 games, but for Troy, he's 22 years old now. You know, he's not a kid anymore.
That's knife edge in football, in terms,
you have to be starting to show a little bit of cop on. You can't be making basic mistakes anymore. You need to start showing that you're a proper professional and you understand the game. So look, Troy can score goals, and with the weight of the world on his shoulders when he first came into the Ireland team, he's gone away now, he's got his CV back up, and yeah, I like him. But when you look at Troy playing, you look at Adam Eda doing so well at Celtic, you look at Evan Ferguson, and everybody thinks when Evan is fit he's going to come into the team, and even Sammy Schmoddick's, even he's one that you could possibly play up the front of the park. But look, for Troy, he just take every game as it comes, keep playing well, and he will force himself into the Irish team at some point. So take every game as it comes, keep doing what you're doing, keep scoring. He scored 4 goals in one of the games there the other week, so we know he knows the way to goal. Alkmaar scored 14 goals in the last 3 games, so one of them was 9 in one of the games. So yeah, look, really, really good. Just keep doing what he's doing, and surely he will force his way into that Irish team at some point.
Yep, sounds good. Fergal, thank you so much for joining us. We'll be talking to you in the next few days again. We're going to take a little break, Keith. Sure, you can stay around. We might see if there's a bit of team news or something. We'll be back to talk of Formula One after these.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. We are turning our attention to Formula One because there is a lot happening both on and off the track. And to talk us through it all, I'm delighted to say that Formula One journalist Declan Quigley joins us on the line. Declan, how are you?
Marie, how's it going? You well?
Ah, good. Look, I'm sure you can predict this, but I'm going to start with what's happening off the track, because you know I love all the drama, but it has been quite high because of Max Verstappen and the punishment that he received for swearing. But there's a few layers to this story, so you might just talk us through, Declan, what's been happening with Max and his punishment.
Can I say, for feck's sake, to begin with, just to get that over with?
Yeah, okay, we'll agree on that. Yeah, let's go for that.
That's we go the Irish way with that. It's absolutely hilarious, isn't it? Mohammed bin Salam, who's the FIA president, somewhat controversial reign, came in December 21 and sort of caused all sorts of shenanigans throughout his reign to this point. He decreed recently that it wasn't acceptable for drivers to be swearing on the radio during races. In the heat of battle, he said that they were going to try and... he didn't like that they even bleeped it out. He just didn't think that drivers should be... didn't think it was becoming. He described this language as bad when he used the F word and said it wasn't good enough at all. Then Max Verstappen went to the last Grand Prix, went to the Thursday press conference and used the F word to describe his car as a little bit becked, I think is probably how we describe it in Ireland. And this sort of got the censure of the FIA, who decided that he was going to have to do something akin to community service, and as yet to be defined, as yet to be entirely outlined. Lewis Hamilton, who has his own difficulties with President Bin Salam over the sort of discussions about whether he should or should not be allowed to wear jewellery in the car going back a couple of years, he said that Max shouldn't bother doing this community service. And then subsequent to that, on Saturday and Sunday, the official FIA press conference, which your drivers in the top three are obliged to attend. Max was there, okay, but he gave yes, no, monosyllabic, work to rule style answers at best. And then afterwards gave a much more fulsome and more elaborate press conference, impromptu press conference, and basically said that he thought this was all rubbish. He wasn't, he thought as far as he was concerned, the kind of words he was using were ordinary street language that kids of five or six not only hear it, but would use it themselves, which is certainly probably true, whether it's whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. And basically, he thought this was outrageous and unreasonable. And plenty of others have kind of rode in behind him. I think one of the best ones is Gerhard Berger. He's a bit of a messer himself in his days, but he's very much part of the establishment now. He's the head of the Grand Prix Drivers Association. And he pointed out quite reasonably that his fellow countryman, Gunter Steiner, who has made a bit of a career out of being famous for his punctuation of his language with the F word, pretty much every second word as the team principal. Latterly the team principal of the Haas team, and that if Gunter Steiner is a superstar for it, it seems unreasonable to censure the drivers over it. Oddly enough, Lewis Hamilton, who thinks that it's a ridiculous penalty, actually thinks it is that drivers shouldn't necessarily say these things on the race radio, even in the heat of battle. I think it's a storm in a teacup. It's hilarious, really. What do you think?
It is a storm in a teacup, but you only have to watch, not to throw about last weekend, but you watch the golf regularly. Someone drives a ball over a hedge, over a hedge instead of down the fairway, and Sky seem to be apologising every 5 minutes for someone's language on a tee. I mean, in the heat of battle, in competition, on the radio, in Formula One, on a soccer pitch, on a golf course, my own language on a horseback would have been colourful at times. Surely in the heat of battle, you turn a blind eye, but I probably can see whereby when you've cooled down in a press conference, it's not acceptable.
Is there a difference? The funny thing is that Max is Dutch. So in the Netherlands, they're much more, a bit more like Ireland, actually, and they're much more likely to sort of pepper their conversation with these kind of adjectives, and they're seen as much more sort of normal behaviour. In fact, it's almost difficult for you and I to have this conversation without using the F word, because let's face it, we all do. And he grew up in the Netherlands. I remember in my days, the Formula One commentator, the Dutch commentators would talk about how they would use the F word in commentary occasionally if they felt that it's, the occasion so merit of it, and that's just the way of it. For him, it just seems absolutely natural, absolutely normal, and he thinks this is outrageous. And of course, you've got those cultural things at play there. And his defense, of course, was that okay, English is not my first language, but he speaks English fluently, and he speaks English in business all the time, and it's almost his first language. He speaks it better, indeed, than a lot of people for whom it is their first language. So it's an odd one.
But Declan, does everything that's gone on around this and the other drivers kind of rowing in behind him, does that point to problems between drivers and the FIA?
Yeah, it's an unusual fight to pick, isn't it, for Mohammed bin Salam? It's been a controversial reign, to say the least. He has had a couple of difficulties with the... I mean, when you think about the power structure in Formula One, he owns the ball, basically, and then Liberty Media own the pitch, or they own the teams. And he's obviously heading up the sports body, so it's his job to police the and look after the sporting regulations and indeed the technical regulations of the sport, whereas Liberty Media are all about trying to make money out of it. And indeed, one of the controversies in the last couple of years was that he said that he thought the sport was overvalued. And of course, that didn't go down too well as a public listed company to be, you know, and a person in his particular role and you know, the sort of exposure that he would get to, you know, that was a very sensitive thing to say, and or insensitive thing to say about a very sensitive subject, and potentially could have had an effect on the valuation of the sport. So he certainly has courted controversy. The jewellery gate issue with Lewis Hamilton going back a couple of years ago, where he said he can't, you know, he can't wear jewellery in the racing car, and Hamilton said, "I've been there 16 years. I'm not going to change now." They paid a few fines. Ultimately, that one went quietly, was brushed under the carpet. And I think this one will as well. And it does compare, doesn't it, with Jean Todt, who was the FIA president before him, and Max Mosley before him. I mean, I remember the Max Mosley days, and Mosley ruled the sport with an iron rod and was somehow perceived to be in cahoots with Bernie Eccleston, who was the sort of, you know, the Liberty Media figure back then. As in the head of the promotion side of Formula One, and they had a very strong relationship. And between the two of them, a driver just wouldn't question the authority of the Formula One. So you wonder what the sort of perceived level of authority that Mohammed bin Salem has as the FIA president, and, you know, really what the future holds for him in that particular role. I mean, he represents 147 clubs worldwide. Sits as the head of sports administrator, but you wonder what sort of pressure they'll be under for him, you know, in the years to come.
More importantly, what's wrong with Max Verstappen's car?
That's just, you know, the others caught up. I mean, there's a sort of an assumption that they must be going slower, but I mean, they always get quicker. You know, as the rules stay stable for any length of time, the cars just get quicker and quicker and quicker, and now it's sort of reached a sort of a plateau in terms of development potential, and the other teams who are a long way behind the Red Bull are kind of catching up. So there's all sorts of talk about how, you know, the back end is it takes a little time to settle it in, then they turn in, and then they've got a little bit of sort of mid and late corner understeer, it's pushing out on the front wheels. But in reality, that was probably already there, but now they're having to push the car a little bit harder to try and keep up in sort of layman's terms. And the other teams are just doing it better, and most particularly McLaren, which seem to have a car right now that suits every single racetrack, every single situation. And they're putting the Red Bull team under such pressure. And Max Verstappen is doing a sterling job, it has to be said. He's absolutely blitzing his teammate, and he's managing to hang on in there, despite the fact that he's got a commanding lead in the World Championship. His situation as world champion in defending that title looks a bit tenuous at the moment.
Looks tenuous. So 6 Grand Prix to go, and it's up in the air. Kevin Byrne, thanks so much for taking our call. We'll be back after this break. Sorry, Declan Quigley. We'll be back after this break to talk to Kevin Byrne.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back to Game On. So we then got around to talking about Colm Walsh and Thomas Carty and of boxing in Dublin at the weekend. So Kevin Byrne joins us on the line. It was a big night for Colm Walsh coming back to Dublin, and he didn't disappoint. Kevin?
Yeah, oh, sorry. I thought you might have been playing the clip there. Yeah, it was absolutely, it was, Ruby. 11-0, Colm Walsh went over to the United States during COVID and, you know, made his reputation, rocked up in Freddie Roach's gym, pleaded could he spar, and he was given the opportunity. And since then, he's kind of snagged a couple of big deals and, made his name over in the States, came home at 11-0. Bit of pressure on his shoulders. But when I put that question to him about, you know, the expectation is there, he and his manager, Tom Loeffler, kind of said he thrives on it. You know, this is what he's built for. And he feels he fights even better under the bright lights and with the big pressure. And he performed extremely well, knocked out Ronofsky in the second round with like a dinger of a 1-2. And really looked prepared for the big stage, and looked prepared to move on to the next stage as well.
Is this a conventional route he's going down, Kevin, or is it a little bit different? Maybe it's because Dana White's involved, it just seems a little bit different.
Yeah, it's certainly different to what anyone else is really doing in Irish boxing at the minute. The McKenna brothers, Aaron and Stevie, did spend time over in the States and boxed in Freddie Roach's gym as well. And, you know, they made their professional starts over there, but are back mainly fighting out of the UK now, albeit Aaron's last fight was in Japan, of all places. But yeah, it kind of harks back to the days of Bernard Dunn. Went over, trained in Freddie Roach's gym himself, and you know, had a big deal around him. He was signed by like Sugar Ray Leonard. When he came back in 2005, he had a 14-0 record, and the same thing, a bit of hype about him, but people at home were looking forward to seeing him in action. He came back versus a guy called Jim Betts in the National Stadium, and stopped him in the fifth round with actually the same referee as Callum Walsh had the other night, David Irving. So there's shades of that. And Dunn had the kind of, Brian Peters, his manager, had set up a deal with RTE, so we could tell this was the beginning of a big journey. And it's kind of the same with Walsh. We could tell it's the beginning of something, because afterwards he and Dana White and Tom Loeffler were talking about next time, and I think what they meant is next homecoming. It's Cork. They're looking at the 30-year anniversary next year of Chris Eubank. Steve Collins down in Cork obviously fought in Mill Street, and then Porky Queeve. So they're aiming high. They're taking a loss on Callum Walsh at the minute, but they're calling it a big investment because they're seeing bright future for him as a kind of box office star. And I put it to Dana White. Obviously, he's promoted Conor McGregor for all these years and, you know, made oodles of money. Could Callum Walsh become a $100 million fighter? And he thinks that's his future, you know. So, like, lofty dreams, but he's got a lot of ability and a lot of confidence in his ability to get there.
Yeah, he seems like he still seems quite grounded, though, even though he has that confidence. There's a good balance about him. We've had him in a couple of times just chatting over the last few years when he's been back. And that, how important, though, Kevin, is it for him to have a little bit of patience? Because it is a journey when you're in professional sports.
Absolutely. And I think the best thing about it is he knows he's got power, and he says he can knock anyone out with it. You know, as he'd explained the stoppage the other night when he hit Ronowski, he goes, if I hit anyone on the chin with a left hand, they're going down. So I think he's confident enough now to step in with most fighters in the world. But I think they're going to just hold the reins on him a little bit. Like the champions in his weight class are, you know, Fundora, this big tall guy, Fundora, a Mexican, has two world title belts, but Terence Crawford is there as well. So he can be patient in the light middleweight division, or super welterweight, as they call it in the States. He can be patient, but he is stepping up against he's fighting difficult opponents, and that's apparently what caught Dana White's eye, that he is willing to go in against guys with strong winning records from a very early stage of his career. And, you know, he's able to knock most of them down. That was his 10th stoppage, like I say, in 12 wins. So he's flying at the minute, yeah.
This night last week, we had Thomas Carty on, didn't we, Marie? Mm-hmm. He was obviously on the undercard, and he was talking big as well. He was predicting a bright future for himself and a $100 million fight somewhere down the line, and he was brilliant as well.
Yeah, Carty's in a very interesting division. Obviously, you see the razzmatazz of Wembley Stadium the following night, where his sparring partner, Anthony Joshua, was in against Daniel Dubois. And like, the money that they're making, obviously the Saudi Arabia and Riyadh season are, they're effectively controlling heavyweight boxing. They're dictating where the fights take place and who fights who for massive, massive purses, unimaginable purses, really. And Carty's close to that mix, and he's doing the right thing. He's staying patient, developing himself. He's working in sparring camps with the likes of Tyson Fury, Joshua, his manager, Dillian White. So he's picking up great experience along the way, but he's just keeping a lid on. He's not going to rush into taking a fight that's too risky at this stage, but he is eyeing 3-4 fights down the line. He could be in this mix where he's making like millions of dollars, really. Like, so he has to pick the right, his team have to pick the right opponents at the right time. In his last outing at the 3 Arena, he had a guy who kind of ran all night, and it took Carty a long time to catch up with him, but that wasn't the case at the 3 Arena on Friday. Brazilian Jonathan Vergara had a 6-1 record, and you know, he came there to put up a fight to Carty, but he wasn't really able to do so. Carty got a knockout in the last second of the second round, but he was kind of brutalising the guy. He put him down 3 times in that round, and showing a bit of composure and a lot of power. And he's a tricky customer for fighters in that heavyweight division. One of the reasons he gets so much sparring is because he's a big, tall southpaw, and there's not that many of them around, and that causes problems. And everybody wants to learn how to fight southpaws, because obviously Alexander Usyk is the top man in the division. And Carty has that in his locker as well. He's a lefty, big puncher. And that moves him on a grade as well. Like, I mean, the standard of his opponents will rise in time, but I think he's getting very much used to the big stage, fight weeks. Very good at talking to the media and getting his point across. And, you know, as he gets racks up a few more knockouts, a bit more savagery into him, then we'll see him in bigger fights, no doubt.
We had Emmett Brennan in as well, who also had a good night. Good night all round for everybody.
good night for the Dubs, really, because you had Craig O'Brien beating Limerick's Edward Donovan, taking his undefeated record. You had a debutant, Garrett Dowling, as well, opened the professional side of the card with a big win in the second round. And obviously, Emmett Brennan got the decision against Kerry's Kevin Cronin. Split decision in that one, very close fight. I had it a draw myself, put that up on my social media and got pelters from people saying that Kevin Cronin definitely won the fight by 2 and 3 rounds. And look, he was extremely aggressive throughout. And I think Kevin Cronin walks away from that fight with his reputation enhanced. I think Brennan might have hurt his hand, and we'll know he can probably fight even better than he did. I wouldn't rule out a rematch down the line, but super middleweight in Ireland, a lot of good contenders in that division. There's Cork's Tommy Hyde and plenty of other guys. A lot of fan friendly fights that can be made in that division.
Yeah, and just overall then, Kevin, to have boxing going without a hitch in Dublin is always positive, and everyone just seemed to have a really enjoyable night.
Absolutely. Like, I mean, the last two cards in the Three Arena have been headlined by Katie Taylor. Massive nights, you know, worldwide attention on them, but those are few and far between. It took Taylor an awful long time to get home to Dublin for Eddie Hearn to arrange that. And we were kind of waiting for it for so long. But to see a guy like Callum Walsh, who's not even at world title stage, headline the card. It's 10 years since anyone did that. It was Matthew Macklin, the last guy to do that in Dublin. And it does point to more regular nights, big nights in Irish boxing. There's another card at the National Stadium in a couple of weeks. Joe Ward is headlining that. But before that, at the Red Cow, there's an Irish title fight, Senan Kelly versus Matthew Tindall. That's a Jay Byrne promotion. So there's a lot of activity in the capital, and there's plenty going on up in Belfast as well. And one of the things that's been happening in Irish boxing in the last 2 or 3 years is they haven't been afraid to move it around as well. There's been cards in Waterford, cards in Cork, talk about Limerick as well. There's Galway is a place as well. Kieran Malloy headlined there last year at Leisureland, and he's in and around the same mix as Callum Walsh. Ireland is blessed with lads around the 154 division. Like, Callum, I think, is ranked probably the highest of them at the minute. But you've got the likes of Belfast, Cuivin Aguiarco, Kieran Malloy from Galway, Craig O'Brien on the undercard there. He was supposed to fight Callum Walsh in the headliner, but I think he was just eased aside as an opponent. And he won on the undercard against Edward Donovan, but he could come back into the mix. Stevie McKenna from Monaghan, who I mentioned earlier on as well. They're all in around that division. It could make some entertaining fights. I do think Callum Walsh is, I'm not going to say bigger fish to fry, but I think they're looking at a more international agenda. It looks like his next fight's going to be in March. Probably a bit too cold, the weather back in Ireland, to bring him back to Cork then. And we could be looking at next summer for that, but he could be like a backup Madison Square Garden headlining a Paddy's Day card. And in that way, he kind of inherits the mantle from Michael Conlon, who in turn inherited it from John Duddy and stuff in the past. So yeah, it's good news for Irish boxing, because you have Callum Walsh headlining at the Garden next year, but then you'll also have other Irish fighters on the undercard. So it gives opportunities to kind of up-and-comers as well to get some work in and get their names known.
Yeah, sounds good. Kevin, thank you for bringing us up to speed on all that, and so glad that it was a good night for most of the people involved. Obviously, some people lost as well.
Obviously, the boxing match, Marie. Still is going to be a loser.
Well, we have a winner, because we have the competition winner, Ruby. So the EA Sports FC 25 competition winner for today is Jordan Doyle. So Jordan gave us the correct answer of Shamrock Rovers as the team that won the SSC or Trusty League in 2023. If you missed out today, tune in tomorrow. There's going to be another chance to win a copy of EA Sport 25. Ruby, before we finish up, there is racing going on at the moment.
Yeah, Listowel Marie, the Harvest Festival started last Sunday. Tomorrow, of course, is the feature day at the Guinness Kerry National at 4:20. Cracking contest as well. I mean, Florian Porter is your favourite, Percival de Galois, Solitary Man, the real whacker over from England, former winner of the Brown Advisory. Oh, it's a quality contest, and it's a good festival, Listowel, and it really kicks off tomorrow, where there'll be huge crowds.
Will you be going down?
I am there tomorrow, and I'll be there again on Thursday, Marie, for the Liam Healy Memorial Lar Teague Hurdle, which will be a cracking contest as well. But Thursday, Friday is Ladies' Day. It'll be jambers in the stall, Marie.
Right. And what's the weather?
I have no idea. I'm
Did
in Kildare.
Check the weather before you go. I worry
about it. Just I think it's September, October, September in Ireland. You put everything in the car.
Okay, well, that is it from us. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Andrew and Lord Lee behind the scenes. Shane's back tomorrow, and the new music show is up next.